Thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. When someone gives me a topic like the global perspective on food allergies, I always find myself opening the travel file and then scratching my head and saying, well, what should I really talk about? It kind of gives me a license to talk about anything I choose, so that's what I did. But I've worked on food allergies for 30 to 35 years now, so my own personal experience with food allergies even goes back further than David was talking, and it goes back to the time when I toiled in obscurity because no one cared about my research. But over the years, I've been able to put together a research program at the University of Nebraska that's attracted a fair bit of industry funds with the notion that since I'm an academic, my job is to provide the food industry with the tools they need to manage this issue. And so that's going to be the focus of my presentation. But I can probably, because David did such a good job, run through some of these first slides pretty quickly. You know, on a global perspective, I think in a worldwide perspective, the allergen issue emerged kind of slowly at first, probably beginning in the late 1980s. And I started doing research on food allergies in the late 1970s. I guess I'm getting to be an old guy. But it had become a major public health focus in several countries by the late 1990s due to some of the episodes that David talked about right here in the UK. And the awareness in public health agencies really, I think, began to emerge in the late 1990s. And before that, they kind of successfully ignored the issue. They may not have been completely unaware of it, but wasn't on their priority list. And so why did this happen? Well, years ago, I was given a big award by a food society in the state of Minnesota, and so they asked me to make a special presentation, which I titled Food Allergies, From Chaos and Concern to Commitment and Control. And I delivered that talk in about 1998, and I haven't dusted it off since. But I thought I'd update it a little bit for you here, because I think we had chaos in the late 1980s and up through the late 1990s. And why did that exist? Well, I don't have quite as impactful slides as David did. My own daughter's allergic to peanuts as well, although, curiously, the first evidence of that occurred 6 months after I started working on peanut allergy. One of the great coincidences of my career. Fortunately, my daughter's still alive, but it certainly gave me impetus to work harder on this subject and maybe not divert into some other subject. But the first paper that really talked about fatalities was a paper published out of the Mayo Clinic by my now retired friend and sometimes collaborator, John Yenninger. And it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it documented 8 fatalities. And then in 1992, there was another one published by Hugh Sampson and colleagues, 6 deaths, 6 near deaths, all among infants and children up through teenagers. The Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network in the United States was founded by a frustrated consumer and by the name of Ann Munoz Furlong in 1991, and so it's been a very effective organization. I think it was these 2 papers that spurred the Food and Drug Administration in the United States to take notice of food allergies, because recalls in the United States, product recalls of packaged foods, begin in earnest in 1992. And just like here, FDA's had a variety of activities that have been helpful to this subject. Internationally, I always point to Canada. In my view, Canada led the way on allergen issues from the late 1980s. And again, serendipity falls into the issue. There was the Canadian food industry, they don't have the headquarters of very many companies. They have subsidiaries of many of the companies that exist here in Europe or in the United States. And they're mostly headquartered in Toronto area, and the CEOs of the Canadian subsidiaries apparently are friendly with one another. And there was a party hosted by one of these CEOs at his own home, in his own backyard. And the child of another CEO has anaphylaxis at this food industry party in the late 1980s, right there in front of the CEOs of all of the other major Canadian companies who, I mean, these are decisive guys and ladies. That's why they have their jobs. And so at that very afternoon, the food industry group in Canada was told that this was a priority issue and they needed to deal with it. And so they actually produced an awareness video. They also had, partly because of that event, very highly publicized fatalities. They're not very highly publicized, never have been in the United States, not like here in the UK or in Canada. But there was one young lady who died at school. Her name was Sabrina, and that led to Sabrina's Law, which revolves around banning peanuts in schools in the province of Ontario in Canada. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency also began to initiate recalls in this period. Canada was one of the first countries to institute May Contain labeling. I'm not sure we'll view that as an asset, but they were there. So the UK also, I've always had great respect for David Redding. It's amazing he can get up here and talk about his daughter's death. I don't know that I could do that if I was in his shoes. And so there lots of publicity here. Sweden was the first country to develop an allergy death reporting system. Several companies have these now. And the United Nations led the development of the allergen lists. And they listed the big eight. When Europe came along, they added sesame seeds, mustard, and celery, and now mollusk and shellfish and lupin to that list. But in many countries, including the United States, it's only the big eight that are listed. And so there's new regulatory approaches and slightly different regulatory approaches around the world. And I decided I wasn't going to say a whole lot about that because most of you are British food companies or European. Some of you may know as much about that or more than I do. Besides, it's confusing. So allergens have become a key issue, I think, because of these published deaths. Because of the advocacy support groups, they've been very effective. Together with the fact that, you know, our infant feeding practices may have actually been wrong and leading to an increased prevalence of food allergies. Clinically, there's certainly an increased awareness of food allergies, an increased diagnosis of food allergies. In the meantime, the food industry is out there adding value added to everything, and that includes adding things like fish and nuts to things that didn't ever have them when I was a kid. But we've had some new tools, too, because we're going to talk a lot about detection because that's a key control tool. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, we had no way to detect the residues if they were present. Of course, we have company liability issues. That's especially true in the United States, where if you do anything wrong, you're likely to get sued. So we went from early chaos to concern, followed by commitment and control. And I think how far we are along this continuum varies from one country to another, but I think the UK is fairly far along this continuum, and at least I hope so. You all have better awareness of that probably than I do. But, you know, my benchmark doesn't go back all that far. 1990, we had a lack of knowledge and awareness. We had some lessons from the sulfide issue that occurred in the 1980s. There was a lot of resistance to change. We've done this way for 50 years. Why do we need to change now? There's a complex web of ingredient suppliers. It can be the supplier of the supplier of the supplier that's the problem person, and discovering all of that can be quite the challenge. There was a lack of recognition of corporate vulnerability to these issues. And then sort of related to this resistance to change is the focus on minutia. And you know, you focus on minutia and you miss the forest for the trees. But there were major company recalls occurred in the United States from key corporate mistakes, undeclared rework in food products, inadequate cleaning of shared equipment, line crossovers, packaging errors, sticking the product in the wrong package, and then issues associated with ingredient suppliers and custom processors or toll manufacturers. The industry learned a lot from all of these issues. And this is the U.S. list of food recall incidents. My organization keeps track of this. And we've had, as you can see, in the early 1990s, late 1980s, there were none. Were there no allergies occurring in the United States in the late 1980s? I suppose there probably were. We just didn't do anything about it. And then very slowly they began. And as industry awareness increased, they began to blow the whistle on themselves. FDA came along and encouraged some of these companies to do recalls. So we've had a steady increase. And this number could be much higher. The FDA is not very vigorous in their examination of products on the marketplace for undeclared allergens. I always say my laboratory group can go out to any grocery store in America and find a product that has undeclared allergen in it. It's relatively easy. It's much harder to do now than it was in 1990, but it's still true in every single store in America. I would make that wager. In Canada, we track Canadian recalls too. Similar story, except they're much more vigilant about actually testing things, especially imported foods. They like to, they prefer to give problems to American companies that try to ship things across the border or European companies than to target their own manufacturers. So as a result of that, we've had a move to commitment. The Institution of Improved Good Manufacturing Practices and Allergen Controls in the Food Industry, the Institution of Improved Sanitation Practices, changes in facility and equipment design, lots more training. There wasn't any in 1990. The Food Allergy Issues Alliance, which was a group formed among the many trade associations that exist in the United States. Of course, industry groups are supporting consumer awareness groups like FAN and like the Anaphylaxis Campaign. That's terrific. Ann Munoz Furlong used to always say, we're all in this together. And that's a wonderful comment because that's absolutely true. And industry was responsible for the formation of our research group as well. So we were formed in 1996. From seven companies. We now have 57 member companies from 11 countries, but we're a food industry-sponsored consortium aimed at doing research to provide tools for the toolbox methods development for food allergen issues. And we want to develop these tools that industry can use to assess and control analytical risks. And I don't have time to talk about this whole issue today, or they'd have to give me 2 days to do that. But we've begun to develop risk assessment approaches that allow appropriate management of the allergen issue for balanced protection of allergic consumers and maintenance of their quality of life. We haven't quite got this right yet. We're a bit over the top. And my classic example to that is the proliferation of advisory or may contain labels. So let's talk about detection. These are the tools that are out there now. This is where we started in 1996, but lots of other people have contributed to this as well. The first method was actually published way back in 1990 by John Skerritt in Australia. It was an ELISA method for the detection of gluten. It was commercialized soon after that. The first peanut ELISA that came along from Neogen Corporation was marketed in 1996. That was the first one developed out of our group. Now there are many different methods and formats from numerous countries from around the world, and the food industry has the analytical tools needed to detect allergen residues. So we have these tools, but I don't think we have ideal awareness of how to best use these tools. So I say, be careful. Not all of these allergen methods are created equally. And do you know which one is best for your needs? I find that the answer to that question is pretty startlingly bad in a lot of cases. And the right choice for one application may be dead wrong for another. The results can differ both qualitatively and quantitatively, and the food industry's ability to select the best method and interpret the results obtained with those methods is still well short of ideal. So guess what we're going to talk about? So we have various detection methods. We have these enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays. We have general protein tests. We have ATP tests. We have PCR tests. And I don't have time to tell you about the basics of all of these, but ELISA tests detect protein, either specific proteins or proteins from a specific source, like peanuts. And they exist as quantitative 96-well kits, lateral flow strips or dipsticks or swabs. They're specific, they're sensitive, and they can be very quick. They detect protein from the source. They're not always specific for an allergenic protein, but I've always argued that may not be a source of concern. If I can detect peanut protein, I assume all of the peanut proteins are represented there. It doesn't matter to me whether I can detect the specific allergenic protein. Trying to detect one protein instead of many may actually be disadvantageous in some situations if that protein doesn't survive processing as well as some other protein might. They're sensitive. They measure down to low part per million levels, and that could change if it was necessary. I don't think it is. The limit of quantitations are in the area for the quantitative tests, 1 to 2.5 parts per million. I don't think there's any clinical reason to chase molecules here. Developing more sensitive tests. See, the industry could do that. The kit industry could do that. But I don't think it's necessary to protect public health. It would lead to more products being labeled. I'm not sure that we're at a stage where that's necessary. And we have both quantitative and qualitative formats for these tests. So commercially, we have tests for almost all of the food products on the European list. We don't have test methods for some of the tree nuts. We don't have a good test method for fish. There's too many of those critters. The test methods are too specific. And our group has all of these, including some of the ones which are not on, nobody's commercialized cashew and pistachio and pecan assays, because there's probably not enough money to be made, but there are some others that you can use if you go to the laboratory that developed them. But these tests are not all created equal. They vary in specificity, sensitivity, format, and whether they're qualitative or quantitative. So one of the issues is antibody specificity, total protein versus a specific allergenic protein. I think this is the most robust way to do it, but you can argue with me if you'd like. Polyclonal versus monoclonal antibodies. Again, I would say this is the most robust approach, but this has advocates as well. The calibrators that you use for the test, we could all benefit from harmonization on this piece. The effects of processing on detection, not widely studied. Extraction methods, they vary from company to company, and kit to kit, and sensitivity limits. So I don't have time to talk about all those things. I'll just illustrate some examples. So you need to ask the question, what do you really want to measure? And my best example for ELISA kits is to look at milk, because there are kits out there that measure total milk. There are kits out there that measure beta-lactoglobulin, a whey protein, and there are kits out there that measure casein. And I just mentioned some of the manufacturers here. There's more. And some of the BioPharm just came out with their own total milk kit. So, and they have a casein kit, too. And Neogen has a casein kit, too. So don't worry too much about it. But you need to ask yourself the question, what do I really want to measure? And then what protein source is used as the standard in the method? I would argue that we should put the results in terms of milk protein or non-fat dry milk, but sometimes the results are reported in parts per million casein or parts per million beta-lactoglobulin. How do you put that in clinical terms relative to threshold doses for milk? So, specificity, total milk, peanut or RAH1. I already mentioned the milk issue. And soy flour versus processed soy. Soy is a tough one, by the way, a very tough one. And so we've got these quantitative. I just picked Neogen because we partner with them, so I know a lot about their methods, and they have a lot of different quantitative kits. Many of their competitors have a similar range. They're not identical. You have swab tests that are qualitative. They're quick. They usually have 5 parts per million standards. So it's plus or minus at 5 parts per million. But these are intended for use on for sanitation equipment assessment on equipment surfaces. And you have these lateral flow strips, these dipsticks. Again, quick, typical detection limits of around 5 parts per million. Again, primarily used for sanitation assessment, although some companies are using them for qualitative food product testing as well because they're quick. You also have general protein tests, and one that's very popular in the United States is 3M's product called CleanTrace. They have competitors too. It's a swab method for detection of protein based on the Bayer-Rett reaction. It detects protein regardless of the source, so it's not specific for the allergenic source of the protein. The detection limits in our hands are not low enough for allergen detection in many cases, so they're not as sensitive as the detection limits of the allergen swab tests that various companies have, and they don't always correlate well to allergen ELISAs because you'll be picking up protein from any number of different sources in most food industry cases. But these can be good for sanitation assessment. It's just that they're cheaper than allergen swab tests. The ATP tests are also very popular in the United States for sanitation assessment. There's a product on the market in the United States that's specific for, supposedly specific for allergens, but it's really not. ATP levels vary between foods, and this test doesn't prove the presence of protein, and it's the protein that causes the problem with allergens. And they've not been shown to correlate with specific ELISA tests. And then we have PCR methods. These can be very specific. These measure DNA from the source, not the allergenic proteins. They usually correlate very well with ELISA tests. They can be extremely sensitive, more sensitive than ELISA tests. They're not as easy to quantify, so I view them as semi-quantitative. They're certainly going to vary depending on what DNA primers used, but they're available for many allergenic food sources, and they can be rapid and they can be adapted to multiple screens, like trying to detect residues of all of the tree nuts at the same time, which you can't do with currently with ELISA testing. So PCR testing is available for many allergenic foods, but most companies would have to send out the samples. I always say PCR is not particularly practical for implant use. It requires really expensive equipment, and it requires access to an isolated lab that doesn't have environmental contamination, and that's hard to do in a food company in a processing environment. And there's some things that can't be differentiated by PCR that come from the same source, basically. But there are things that you can test besides the food. So you can test equipment surfaces, environmental surfaces, rinse water from CIP systems, in-process, push-through product can be used for testing purposes. So in the United States, I would say that many companies are now testing for allergen residues. The lateral flow strips are really the preferred method for doing this because they're in-house. You don't have to send out. Many companies, only a few companies, are able to do the quantitative tests in their own laboratories, in processing facilities. So there's widespread use of contract labs. My own group is one of those contract labs. But many companies are not testing finished product. They're testing to validate sanitation or allergen control practices, and then testing finished product after you've already validated your allergen control program. I always say test when you're 99.99% sure that you're not going to find anything. It's a whole lot more agreeable in that circumstance. So I want to switch gears a little bit because, you know, my major point with analytical methods is we have quite an arsenal of analytical methods. It's really the proper use and interpretation of those methods that's a challenge. And our group continues to work on analytical methods, but mostly on trying to figure out the effects of processing. And we've devoted a lot of our attention now to the risk assessment piece. Once you have all this information, how do you use it? And a lot of it boils down to knowing about thresholds. We have this proliferation of labeling mostly because we don't have any agreement on what the thresholds are. So how much is too much, which is related to how clean is clean enough, and when is it appropriate to apply an advisory label? Those are all corollary questions to the same overall question. So as I speak, we live in a world without thresholds, where uncertainty abounds regarding safety or lack of safety of various products for food allergic consumers. In some countries, the world's reasonably safe, at least for packaged foods, but loaded with restricted choices. In my ideal future, I begin to wonder whether I'm going to live long enough to see my ideal future, we establish finite threshold levels based on scientifically defensible clinical data. We then become much more certain, because we have science, about the level of risk posed by any given product for a food allergic consumer. The world remains reasonably safe, at least for packaged foods. I'm not sure what we're going to do about food service products, with many fewer restrictions. And all countries are equally safe with respect to food allergies because they're all basing their decisions on the same science. So, you know, why are we interested in thresholds? Well, I stole this from a UK guy, so I thought I should give him credit since I'm speaking in his country, René Crevel from Unilever. And he said it so well that I stole his slide. Very small amounts of specific allergens can provoke reactions in some individuals, but we don't know in how many. We don't know how small the amounts are. We don't know how the severity of the reaction relates to an individual's sensitivity. And allergic people might react differently on different occasions. So it's difficult to assess how much needs to be done to achieve the desired level of safety. Well, what's the industry going to do in this situation? Overlabel, especially with respect to advisory labels. Because no one's telling you how much is too much. So any amount might be too much. How do you know? You're not in any position to make that decision, I would say. So now, a little academic lesson. We're going to talk in toxicology terms, because there's no difference between allergy and any other toxic substance, except these are toxins only to certain people. So we're going to talk about the no observed adverse effect level, the highest amount that an individual can tolerate before experiencing symptoms, and the lowest observed adverse effect level, the lowest amount that would provoke an allergic response in an individual. And you can have both objective NOELs and LOELs and subjective NOELs and LOELs. I'm going to focus on the objective ones. These are based on observable symptoms like hives or vomiting. Subjective ones would be based on non-confirmable responses like mouth itching, very mild and transitory, mostly. And we're going to talk about individual thresholds that exist for each individual subject with a food allergy. And we're going to talk about population thresholds for the whole group, all peanut allergic individuals, or maybe all peanut allergic individuals from a particular clinic or subgroup. And then, of course, the ideal world's the regulatory threshold, an allowed amount or concentration that would be safe for the vast majority of individuals in a group, such as peanut allergic consumers, and it would be based ideally on the population, NOELs and LOELs, and risk assessment modeling, and then food industry thresholds, which would be predicated on the regulatory threshold, I'm rather sure. So historically, physicians and allergists recommended a complete avoidance, which is the zero threshold concept. We knew that ingestion of small amounts, but they're never well defined, could elicit allergic reactions. We had a general idea that severe reactions were caused by bigger doses, but that's not very well defined either. Clinically, double-blind placebo-controlled food challenges serve as the gold standard. But many times these diagnostic challenges were started at what I consider relatively high doses historically. 500 milligrams was the standard. 20% or more of peanut allergic patients react to the first dose. It's 500 milligrams. Some of them had severe reactions. It's 500 milligrams. I always say at this point to non-clinical audiences, I'm surprised they never killed anybody, but they didn't. So in terms of dose response, peanut allergic consumers have also practiced complete avoidance. That's what their doctor told them to do, zero threshold. Peanut allergic consumers still experienced occasional allergic reactions. David told you about some of those. Note I put food service in caps. They deserve that so far. Unexpected allergic reactions to peanuts were occasionally severe, leading to the widespread belief that low doses elicited severe reactions. I want to challenge that concept. I think severe reactions are caused by people attempting to practice complete avoidance who make big mistakes in their avoidance diets and inadvertently eat large doses. So by 2005, just a few years ago, we knew that trace amounts could elicit allergic reactions, and we knew that individual thresholds existed for each and every patient, but they were variable from one individual to another. Not so much within the individual, but between individuals. A few clinics had started doing very low-dose, double-blind, placebo-controlled food challenges, starting at doses much lower than 500 milligrams, and they proved that safe doses existed for every subject, and that severe reactions did not occur at very low doses. But public health authorities have not yet established regulatory thresholds. Labeling in some countries, United States serves as a great example, are based on a de facto zero threshold. And industry is acutely aware of allergens, and since there's no guidance on threshold, they make rampant use of precautionary or advisory labeling. And I always like to pick on Walmart. You know, if you're going to go after somebody, pick on the 800-pound gorilla. So this is the, just one example. I could humor you with many crazy examples in the United States. This is baking soda. Allergy warning, manufactured in a facility that processes milk, eggs, walnuts, peanuts, wheat, and soybeans. Maybe that's justified. I have no idea where Walmart gets its baking soda and whether the facility really contains all of these things or not, or whether there's any real risk here. Never analyzed this product. But, you know, I teach in a food science department. I would hope that as food scientists, we could figure out how to make baking soda that did not require an advisory label. And I've even seen bottled water with may contain peanuts on it. Unfortunately, I didn't take a picture of the label. That was in Canada, by the way. That's why I didn't take a picture. The quality of life for peanut allergic consumers suffers partly as the result of the seriously restricted food choices. And as David mentioned, some consumers ignore precautionary labels. Some physicians even tell their patients to ignore these precautionary labels. And allergic reactions continue to occur in the United States, but rarely with packaged foods. So the U.S. Food and Drug Administration did a really good thing in 2006. They established a threshold working group within their agency and invited some experts to serve on that. I wasn't one of them. I was considered too biased, because I am. You can tell that already. And they published approaches to establish thresholds for major food allergens and for gluten in foods. And if you haven't read this 40-some page report, I would tell you that it's worthwhile reading. I don't always brag about government reports, but this one's really good. And it looked at approaches. It didn't advocate what the threshold should be. And FDA said in 2006 that they favored the use of quantitative risk assessment-based approaches. Based on the knowledge of individual threshold doses within the overall population of individuals with a particular food allergy and using statistical dose distribution modeling, but indicated that that's the most data-intensive approach. And I'll take the 40-some page report and boil it down to one sentence, or maybe it's a couple of sentences. The quantitative risk assessment-based approach provides the strongest, most transparent scientific analysis to establish thresholds for the major food allergens. However, the currently available data are not sufficient to meet the requirements of this approach. A research program should be initiated to develop applicable risk assessment tools and to acquire and evaluate the clinical and epidemiological data needed to support the approach. Well, there was my challenge for the next few years. They outlined my major objective. And so we took on the challenge. First question we have is, were they really right? Do we have enough data, or can we create enough data to use this approach? And I teamed up with Unilever, and I want to acknowledge some of my own staff members and some financial support from ILSI. And we started with peanuts. Peanuts allergies prevalent, severe, and we thought there might be more data on peanuts than a lot of other allergenic foods. Renee was the lead author on the first publication, which was how to use this quantitative risk assessment-based approach. Can we find enough data points in the published literature to use this model? So that was task number one. We mined individual NOEL and LOEL data on peanut from existing published literature, and we focused on objective signs and symptoms rather than the subjective ones. And we've published this a couple of years ago. And then we moved on to task number two. Now I'm going to talk about these together because you'll see why in a minute. We mined additional existing but unpublished clinical data based on individual threshold doses, and that's still ongoing. When we examined the clinical literature, we determined that there was a group in France that likely had data on low-dose challenges of large numbers of peanut allergic subjects that had never been published. When we looked at, we found three publications from this group, and we were able to glean information on 21 individual thresholds from those three papers, but we knew that even in those three papers, there was more than 100 subjects for which the way they reported the data, we couldn't figure out what their individual thresholds were. So we went to Dr. Mona Ray Vatron and we asked her, can we pay you to mine your data for us? She did. We obtained data on 286 peanut allergic subjects. And because she challenges everyone that comes to her clinic, there wasn't very much selection bias like there might have been in the publication studies. So this is just the modeling of the entire dose distribution from both of these studies. It's a log normal dose distribution. The choice of the model doesn't make any difference. I want to point out to you that there's like five orders of magnitude in on the individual threshold doses of individuals with peanut allergy. So the most sensitive individuals that we've ever encountered begin to have objective reactions at 0.4 milligrams of peanut. But there are other people with equally impressive histories of peanut allergy who have to have 8 grams of peanut to have a response. That's a whole handful. That guy just has to remember when he goes to the bar not to drink so much that he forgets he's allergic to peanut. So we determined from these studies that you could put them together because the data from the two different sources are almost identical in terms of their predictions of the eliciting dose that would be predicted to provoke reactions in 10% of all peanut allergic individuals. So this is getting at that population threshold. This isn't the threshold number you'd use. It's 10% of people would react at that level. That's way too high. Even 5% is probably too high. We might use something like the 95% lower confidence interval of the EDO5. That's 3.6 milligrams of whole peanut. But you can see we have data on 450 peanut allergic individuals. I think that's enough information for public health authorities to begin to decide what to do. Also, because the NANC group looks at everyone, we were able to compare the ED10s of people who presented with histories of severe reactions to peanuts and compare them to people who presented with histories of less severe reactions to peanuts, and we found out they're just about the same, meaning that the people with severe reactions are not more sensitive. They're just people who made big mistakes in their avoidance diets and got nasty reactions. So that one's been published too last year. So you can get more data on this from those. I want to switch gears here. And talk about now how we're going to use this kind of information to benefit all of you. So we can use this information in a variety of different ways, but one way that was low-hanging fruit, if you will, was to do a market survey of the risk assessment of foods containing advisory labels. And this is a project done by our graduate student, Ben Remington. My colleague, Joe Baumert, deserves great credit here. So we looked at quantitative risk assessment of foods having peanut advisory labeling. Are these really risky or not? Should they have labels or should they not? So we had done an initial survey of products, analytical survey of products in 2005. Ben repeated the study in 2009. Here's what we found. This is for the United States. If you want to read about the 2005 survey, it's published. The 2009 one's not yet published. But in 2005, if you go out and analyze 200 products with advisory labels for peanuts, 7% of them contain peanuts. In 2009, 8.6%. I don't think those are really all that significantly different. And many of them contained very low levels of peanut, but they were detectable. The limit of detection was 2.5 parts per million. We used the Neogen Veritox test. But the highest levels were a bit more significant. And here's the categories of products. We tried to be similar in our selection of products in the two different categories. Obviously, anyone in the food business knows you won't find the same products on the market 4 years after the first survey. We're not that good. We focused on what we call nutrition bars, and these are energy bars. And we focused on them because they had, you can see there's a lot of zeros here, the products in categories with where we couldn't find any detectable peanut. We could have some discussion about that, or very low levels of detectable peanut. But nutrition bars were the richest category. And that's probably because in the United States they're made by a lot of smaller companies. So we're talking about these kinds of products. Here's one that has a bunch of different, no reason to pick on this one except it's just an example. It comes in 8 delicious flavors. I think this is right off their website. We wanted to assess the consumer risk of reactions of consuming products with voluntary advisory labeling for peanuts. So this one says, may contain traces of peanuts and other nuts. And one of these has fudgy peanut butter cup variety, undoubtedly made on shared equipment. So here's all those other varieties. So this is how we do probabilistic risk assessment modeling. So you've already seen the dose distribution of thresholds. Now we have product analysis where we have the levels of peanut in various products in part per million levels. And in the United States, we have the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, commonly known as the NHANES, that provides us with consumption pattern data so that we can determine the allergen intake. And so it's where these two interact, and the most sensitive people end up with the most highly contaminated product where you have a risk of an allergic reaction. So you've seen this part, and We added to it the prevalence of peanut allergy. This is from a very recent publication. And pick out the part, people allergic to both peanuts and tree nuts, people allergic to peanuts only. Those are the people that we want to know what the prevalence is. The prevalence is 0.76% of the American population is allergic to peanuts, according to this survey done in 2008. And this is the dose distribution of thresholds that you saw before on a slightly different scale. So the curve looks a little bit different, but it's the same one. And you've seen this before. So the lowest provoking dose, I'll remind you, is 0.4 milligram of whole peanut. We found 4 individuals with that dose, but no one reacted to 0.1 milligram. The model will predict the possibility that more sensitive people do exist. And you can set a population threshold if we can decide on an acceptable level of risk. So now the NHANES survey. One thing we know is we got to figure out what's the probability that people that are allergic to peanuts are actually going to ignore the advisory labeling and eat these products. And you can see that in some cases as many as 40% of individuals attending a Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network patient conference would ignore some of these labeling statements and eat the products anyway. And that's also in that 2007 publication. So we said it's 40%. So the survey examines nationally representative sample of about 5,000 people every year and tries to get a representative sample and then extract consumption data based on product category, age, and sex. And here's just an example of this thing is quite data intensive. So there were actually several products that you could find codes for, and then things like meal replacement bars that are the or high protein bars that are the catch-all categories for something that wasn't a particular brand name product. And this is the NHANES consumption data fit onto a log normal curve. So there were almost 17,000 people surveyed. 156 of them ate nutrition bars sometime during the 2-day observation period, and that means that 0.93% of them ate nutrition bars. And they either ate one, two, or more. The initial peanut advisory labeling study, you saw this data before. I just remind you, these are the data that we used on analytical information. We've seen this before. So there's the product analysis information fit to the log normal curve as well. Now we put it all together. See how easy that was? And then we do these Monte Carlo simulations where you pick, the computer picks millions of times from each one of these curves to tell you how likely it is that an event's going to occur in someone. So we have 0.93% consume, 19.2% of these products have peanut at various levels, 0.76% of the population are allergic to peanuts, 40% of them are likely to purchase these products even though they have advisory labels. So here's all of the components that go into Ben Remington's analysis, and here's the results. So I'll put that in. The reaction probability in peanut allergic user population is 1%. So these people shouldn't eat these nutrition bars. Admittedly, if they pick them at random, only one of 100 of them will react, but I'm going to argue that's too high. The reaction probability in the peanut allergic population is 4 in 100,000 per day. But there's quite a large number of peanut allergic individuals in the United States total. So this actually looks like a low number. It's not necessarily all that low. It would estimate 96 reactions per day in the United States. That's probably too high. That's the reason we put exclamation points there. We're probably too conservative in all of this. And one thing that the program does is that it assumes that there might be peanut allergic individuals with reactions at dose levels far below 0.4 mg. And it also assumes that those same people might eat really large amounts of some of these nutrition bars. That's what statistics does for you. So I don't think that we're having 96 reactions per day. Either they're not eating them. We assumed that peanut allergic consumers were as likely to eat nutrition bars as the general population. That might be true, but we don't know that for sure. We made the assumption about how many of them would ignore advisory labels. This includes very high-level consumption estimates in some cases. And when you go for the 95th and 99th percentile consumption, it gets kind of ridiculous. And the simulation is not brand-specific. And the threshold curve could be skewed to the more sensitive side. Of course, the key conclusion doesn't change. Nutrition bars with advisory labels are risky, and peanut allergic consumers should not eat them. Other food categories showed much lower risks in this survey. So I think I want to go backwards. Is it going to let me? You could do this same thing with your own products. So let's say you have a product and you're trying to decide whether to apply an advisory label. If you analyze 100 random samples, you're going to develop your own product analysis curve. You can determine what the exposure levels are by using various exposure survey information. You probably have something in the UK. I just don't know what it is. And this part would not change. You can decide to use this or not. If you're not going to have an advisory label on the product, then 100% of people would eat it, be likely to eat it. So you just go with this number up here and don't modify it. And you can determine what the risk level is and decide on a very quantitative basis whether you should have advisory labeling or not. We're starting to apply this for various food companies now, and I think this is the next step in the risk assessment approach. So I think we're done. Thank you.